It's a cyber reel 13. You were telling me how the Russians were rounded up for return, or the the Germans had fought with the Russians. Gets complicated. The Russians who fought with the Germans were rounded up and returned. You were saying you marched down the road.
Yes, the my platoon was within a short distance of perhaps half a mile of a bridge. Now I can't recall where it was, but there was this bridge spanning the river, which I believe, but I'm not sure, was called the River Moher, some name like the M-O-H-R, I think. But I'm not positive about it. I can't remember. I know there was a river, and that these Russians were to cross that bridge, and it was a short distance away from where our platoon was. There were tanks and armoured cars, certainly, patrolling up and down this particular road. Yes, the tanks and the armoured cars were patrolling up and down the road. Lots of jeeps flying up and down, various officers and whatnot in them, and motor bikes, DRs rushing up and down. Our own dispatch rider, I knew him very well. He was sharp, I think, and he was going backwards and forwards, giving me various information as to what was going on. As the Russians passed us, in their carts, some were marching, but the carts were mostly had women and children. They had whole families, and they were made to throw their weapons into a Bren gun carrier we had. So this Bren gun carrier gradually filled up with weapons, and then it overflowed, and they were lying on the ground all around, all sorts of weapons. And they were moved forward all the time as quickly as possible, hustled along towards the bridge. I can't say it's true because I didn't see it. And from my experience, that lots of things that people say they participated in, it's only because they've heard a story. But I don't know. But Schaff came back and asked me if I wanted to get onto the back of the bike, his bike, to go down to the bridge and see what was going on. And he told me that they were, the moment they saw that bridge, they started to panic, and they were being threatened with flamethrowers and everything else to get them across the bridge, and that some were jumping into the river. As I said, I can't say it's true because I didn't see it myself. But that is the story that Schaff told me, and I see no reason to disbelieve it. So that was it. They were all pushed back across the river by brute force, apparently, and what happened to them after that, I think most people know. So really, that's all I can tell you about the Russians.
What's the next thing you remember then?
We had a very long period of tree felling. This must have been approaching towards winter then, I suppose. This was to supply fuel for Vienna. We were clearing whole forests, more or less, for quite a long time. We were on short rations ourselves then, as we've been. They cut down on the rations because they were so short of food everywhere. But and they also started up ski patrols by then.
Were you on those?
Hmm?
Were you on those?
Yes. Yes, very good.
You'd have to be taught to ski first.
No. Well, I wasn't taught to, nobody was taught to ski. We were given skis, taken out, shown the slope, and you were now out on ski patrols, again, to visit remote farms, etc., looking for SS. I don't know what the idea was. I don't think there were any SS about, personally. But I think it was just to keep people occupied and to annoy them, in fact, or annoy me anyway. But I remember one particular incident which I found very painful, but people seem to think it's funny, but I can assure you it wasn't funny. Major Tulloch, he was quite proficient on skis, or at least I thought he was, because he could come to a sudden stop. He could approach you at a very, very high speed and then suddenly turn on his skis and shower you with snow. And I thought, you must know what you're doing. You must be able to do that. So anyway, on one particular occasion, we were sent out into the hills and valleys to look for SS, and we came to a very high slope and farmhouse at the bottom. And so I started to go down this slope, and there was a whole company all tearing down this slope, and I was going faster and faster, and I thought, oh, don't like this. So I sat down. You can go along with you. You can go along with two skis in your bottom. So I sat down, and I was going, enjoying it. In fact, I was passing people. I could see, half a body buried in the snow, and a pair of skis waving in the air, and other people falling over in all directions. And I'm going beautifully down this slope. 3 points, bum, and 2 feet. And then everything was fine until I hit a tree stump. And if you ever hit a tree stump buried in the snow at about 30 or 40 miles an hour, believe me, it's painful. So anyway, I eventually got down to the bottom where all the other chaps were. We looked into the farmhouse. As usual, there was nothing there except the farmer and his family. They were sitting down having their midday meal at the long table. Major Tulloch had been travelling around the various places and finding out what the rest of the platoons and the thing people were doing. And he suddenly appeared on the slope. Down he came, and he came down faster and faster. And he came very near. And I thought, oh, you're going to do your usual stunt of showering us all with snow, but he didn't. And I suddenly realised he wasn't going to stop. So I'm standing by the door. So I opened the door. And he went straight through the door. And I heard an almighty crash. And I looked through the door. He's hit the table, and he'd gone the length of the table. Everything that was on the table had been scattered around the room, the kitchen there. There were all the farm people, the farmer and his wife and his girls, they were all girls, young girls, all with their mouths wide open, and at the other end of the table I could see a pair of skis sticking in the air. I thought he's not going to like this at all. So I thought, well, best thing I can do is the disappearing act. I had visions of Major Tulloch coming down and giving me a crack with his ski. So I disappeared round the back and it all went quiet, and time passed and I was having a quiet smoke and I already had a look to see what damage I'd done. And I saw a Jeep. Heard a Jeep in the distance, looking down the Jeep through the snow, and he got a stretcher on the side. I carried Tulloch out and put him on the stretcher and took him away. And I never saw him again, but he'd broken both legs. And that is the last I ever saw of Tulloch. And it was a great pity because I liked him, and it was. If I hadn't have opened the door, he'd have hit the door. And then what damage would he have done? He might have killed himself, in fact. It was a heavy door. But eventually, 50 years had gone by before I ever established contact again with the foresters. And when I asked after Major Tulloch, he died a couple of years ago. He'd stayed in the army and he was a colonel, but he died a few years, 2 or 3 years back, I understand. But it was a great pity. I liked it very much. So that you tend to do that busy visitors. But when I mentioned this to one of the officers, he said, no, Major Tarrant didn't know it wasn't involved. He said, I'll inquire. And then he came back, he said, you're right, he did break those rules. That's how it happened.
How did you take to skiing? Not to yourself, not too well from the stand up.
No, I didn't. I was not a skier, and I didn't like horses. I still don't like horses, and I still wouldn't like to get on skis again. But we went out quite a lot, but I was always falling over, or I think a lot of people were. Tom Renner, as a matter of fact, was sent on a skiing course, and when he returned, from this course, expecting to have a few days with the company, the moment he returned, he was sent out on an extended guard commander somewhere, and the reason for this, which annoyed him very much, I remember it at the time, one of the chaps had, one of the corporals who should have been in charge had taken in, over this guard, I forget what the guard was, it was an extended one somewhere, and we were sitting I think we were in the schoolhouse. We were in the schoolhouse, and a group was in the room when there was a promotion out in one of the outside the room in one of the corridors, and somebody led this corporal in, and his hand was literally cut to pieces, pouring with blood. There was blood everywhere, and he was drunk. And what he'd done was, he'd come into the school, seen the mirror hanging on the wall, and had punched the mirror. And shattered the mirror, and at the same time had cut his hand to pieces. And nobody could get any sense out of him, and he was packed off to a study somewhere. And Tom Reynolds returned, and all was sort of come incidental. And had to take over the guard duty, but he wasn't at all pleased about it. But this was the sort of thing that was going on all the time. It was, I think, people by then were running riot in many ways, doing very silly things.
Such as any other examples?
Too numerous to mention. In fact, the one particular case was the Gamlets. I was two cases there. In fact, we were in a slosh there. Now that slosh, it was something to do with the Bourbon Palmers, because at that time I was looking for pheasants, and I was looking for a gun to shoot the pheasants with. I'd been using my 303, which made a bit of a mess of pheasants. So I was looking for a shotgun, and unfortunately all the cases were inscribed with showing that they belonged, with plates showing that they belonged to the Furzen farmers, but I thought they were all empty. So I never did find a gun. I used to all they used to do was extract the bullet from a 303 cartridge, and I'd get a pencil and a rubber tube round it, about 6 inches, and then get a pair of pliers and cut up pieces of wire and fill the tube up and seal it up, and then take the bolt out of the rifle and push this bullet in with a cartridge in with a 6-inch tube on it, and so they had to take the bolt out to get the cartridge in. But when I fired it, I used to get a sheet of flame 2 or 3 feet long from the barrel, and the pheasants would disappear. weren't very successful with it. So anyway, in this slush, well, I think we were on about the third floor, and we had these. I think they were. They were from the German army beds. They were mostly wooden, and some were shrapnel beds. But a lot of them were small, low wood beds. And I think I don't know how many of us would have been in that room. Very big room. I don't know if there were a whole company of us in there. I'm not quite sure. A lot of us in that room. And at that time, we had two chaps who were always in trouble, one way or another. One was a cockney who was the leader. He always led astray an Irishman, a southern Irishman. This Irishman was like one of those old time barefaced foxes. Barrel chest, he was quite a silk chap, but when he was stripped off and he thrust out his chest, it was a sight to see. But they were always in trouble, and it was this cockney that used to lead the Irishman astray. Should I mention their names?
You know, it doesn't do any harm, I don't think.
Not often. It had been a very long time before anybody ever hears this. It was Pink. Pink was the cockney, and the Irishman was named Flood. And as I said, Pink always led. Flood was a nice chap, but he was always led astray by Flood, by Pink. There were three incidents I particularly remember with these chaps. The first one was one night up in this room, I think it was the third floor. It was a terrible commotion. We had lamps, there were no electricity or anything like that, but most of us have got small oil lamps. I could hear people swearing, cursing, there was something going on. You could hear beds going over. We got our lamps going, and what had we got? We got a huge oxen in the room. Bearing in mind, it was a spiral staircase. Pink and Flood were both as drunk as lords, and somehow or other, they've got this oxen up a spiral staircase onto about the third floor. And there was this wretched thing knocking everybody, running around the room, all the beds were going over. Had to wait till morning. When it came to morning, we tried to get this thing out. Its horns were too wide to go through the door. How they got it into the room in the first place, in pitch dark, nobody could fathom out. Some of the chaps had to get in front and twist its horns sideways, to get it out through the door while the rest pushed it out. And it took us hours to get this wretched oxen down the flights of stairs. That was one incident with them. The second incident was with Corporal Lambert. Again, middle of the night, Flood and Pink both drunk. Commotion. Lights on, lamps on. Corporal Lambert's bed was hanging by the back legs of the bed through the window, and Corporal Lambert was trying to clamber back into the room through on the bed. And this was about, as I say, it was either the second or the third story. He eventually got back into the room. The son was went over and pulled him back in. He would have been killed, I think, if the bed had given way and he'd have fallen through. All settled down in peace again till the next night, when Flood and Pink were having a quiet evening. They were both sound asleep in bed. Another commotion, Lance on. Corporal Lambert there with a huge felling axe, chopping their beds about to pieces around them. How there wasn't an ankle or an arm or a head flying through the air, I don't know. They were both grovelling on the floor. How they weren't chopped to pieces was a mystery. That was another incident. And that was the last incident.
So a fair amount of fairly wild behaviour.
Well, the last incident with Pink and Flood that I can recall was not in that castle. Well, there was another one, but I won't repeat that one. But the last one I do recall was I was back in company headquarters somewhere. By that time there were very, very few people at all. If you went on guard, it was not a question of 24-hour guard, it was a question of you went on guard and you stayed there until somebody relieved you.
This was after the demobilisation, yeah. A lot of demobilisation. Yeah.
It was very, very few. And for some reason or other, I was at company headquarters, and the mate, who was it, mate with that door? It must have been Pryor, it was Major Tullock, so it was Pryor to him being hurt. And he came through the door, he said, get a friend down. And round up anybody you can find. So I took a friend down, and I found Venables. He took his Tommy gun, he said, get the Tommy gun. And I think there were about five of us, all told. That's all that could be found. And Major Tullock was outside in the Jeep. He said, right, get under the Jeep. He said, Flood and Pink are running riot. There's reports coming, they're shooting up the local villages. And we said, we've got to find them before they hurt someone. We got to one village where they just left. The woman with a baby in a pram had snatched the baby from the pram, and there were bullet holes through the pram. So we carried on. I think it was afternoon came, and there were these. We were getting it over the radio. There were reports coming from the Austrian police. These two were literally going from village to village in the town, so shooting up in the area, so shooting up the villages. And we eventually found them on a slope just outside the village somewhere, and. He got out, and he said if they showed the slightest resistance, he said shoot them down. And we got in a half circle to the side of them. And Tullock was to one side, and he put his pistol away, and we were standing to his side, and he walked towards them and told them. If they'd have moved those guns, we'd have shot them. It was as simple as that. Anyway, they put their guns down. It was shortly afterwards, the military police arrived, and they put in handcuffs, and that was the last ever saw them. So, what they got for that, I don't know. But they certainly would have had it in the neck.
Did you go to Vienna when the ceremonial guard?
No. The only ones that went to Vienna were the tall chaps, or the bigger men, the ones that could compare. Venables went several times, but the ones that could, you see, the Russians and the Americans, they took it in turn to, I think it was called the Schönbrunn Palace, and they took it in turns. They went for, I don't know how, what was the time lapse between them, but. They were putting on the Russians and the Germans were Russians and the Americans were putting in their crack people, so to say, and big men. Well, the Americans, a lot of the Americans were very big indeed, but they had to have, when they relieved the guards, obviously they didn't want shrimps in comparison with 6'6" Americans or something like that, or giant Russians. So they chose all the big chaps, the fellows that were over 6 feet to go.
What about recreations? I mean, how did you spend your evenings?
Mostly on guard. In the later months, it was we worked on the Yugoslav frontier, and you would be sent down there and stay there for months at a time, two on and four off. I know the first time that we went to this frontier. It had been a frontier post, and on the opposite side there was a small sort of chalet, which was something to do with an automobile association, and we used to sit there shooting it up outside. We were miles away from the town. I think the town was Speedfield, and we just used to sit there shooting this place until it was like one of these Wild West saloons covered in bullet holes. The first time we went there, there was I don't think they ever did move it. There were giant shells lying around, and these 210 millimeters, I think. I don't think they ever did move them. But we started to, the first thing we always did was to dig latrines, and that caused sight of us digging caused the Yugoslavs to bring up reinforcements, and then we got the message that a jeep tore up and said, "Stop digging at once, the Yugoslavs are getting alarmed, thinking they're going to attack them or something." So we had to stop that, go and dig them at the back somewhere where they couldn't see us digging. But there were two or three, two or three incidents with the Yugoslavs. I know that the platoon before us must have been Christmas at some time or other, Christmas 45, I suppose. Would it been Christmas? I suppose it must have been 45. Or
it will have been, yes.
I don't know, but I know that they marched across the frontier, and the Yugoslavs were drunk in their hut and had them out and drilled them in the road. But we relieved that particular guard, and that night the Yugoslavs came up and set fire to our place. And that was nearly burnt down. That was the sort of things that were going on all the time, and they were there was this continual business of. There was a German-speaking population, a German population of long-standing in Yugoslavia, and they deported them all. When I say deported them, they would take their opportunity to thrust them across the border at night. And if you could, not that we ever did find that happen, but what we were told to do was that if we could stop the Yugoslavs from before they could push them across the border, we should do so. But I never knew it happened, so I don't know how we would have stopped the Yugoslavs. But the Austrian police would come in with reports that these refugees were being pushed across the border to certain places, and they would call the company out. Because it was only the company, the other companies were located elsewhere, and the battalion headquarters was in Leibniz. So, as far as we were concerned, at that particular time, everybody else would cease to exist except our own particular company. And we would be sent out to find them, and it would be waist deep in snow up in these woods and forests that they got there. And we'd find these refugees. Very often there would be the able-bodied men would be either carrying old people or children, and we would take them back to an inn or guest house, in which was a really a sort of pub, in the speed field, I think it was, and get fires going and wait for the trucks to come and take them away to a refugee camp somewhere. But that was happening very frequently.